towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance.
I'm so sorry to keep you waiting. I had the wrong shoes on, and I thought I can't come up here with my flip-flops on. Good afternoon, precious brothers and sisters. I'm so happy that you're here today. The subject is the subject of the summer school, understanding and judgment, or judgment and understanding. A few weeks ago, my husband Joe, I have to mention his name, and I ordered Chinese food from a local restaurant in Kansas City. When I opened the fortune cookie, you want to know what it read? It was a very interesting fortune cookie. It said, "You believe in the goodness of mankind." You believe in the goodness of mankind. Well, I thought to myself, this was as much a question as a statement. So you could say it, you believe in the goodness of mankind? So I thought, these words were a kind of paradox. Because on the one hand, we do. We see much goodness. We see much kindness in mankind. But also, to the contrary, in our external world, we have many things that we could lead us to question the goodness and the kindness of mankind. In the bowl of sake, we find the words of our master, Hazrat Inayat Khan. True justice cannot be perceived until the veil of selfishness has been removed from the eyes. True justice cannot be perceived until the veil of selfishness has been removed from the eyes. The words true justice seemed to hold a resounding echo for me. And so the journey to preparing this paper, this lecture began. Years ago, one of Hazrat Inayat Khan's students asked this question, "Will you please speak about the justice of God's judgment?" Hazrat Inayat Khan answered, "By giving you a little simile, I will show you what a difference there is between man's justice and God's justice. There are two children of the same father, and they're quarreling over their toys. The children have reasons to quarrel over their toys. One child thinks a certain toy is more attractive and says, 'Why should I not possess it?' The other child says, 'That toy was given to me. Why should I not hold on to it? Both the children have their reasons, and both are just. But the father's justice is different from the children's view of justice. The father has not only given the children the toys to play with, but at the same time, he knows, the father knows what is the character of each child and what the father wishes to bring out of each child and whether that particular toy will help bring out that quality and character which the father wishes to bring out of the child. The child does not know this. It happens, perhaps, that the toy seems poor to the one child, and according to that child's sense of justice, he can't understand why that particular toy was given to him and not given to the other child. And if the child were older, he would have accused the father of injustice. But he does not know the justice of the father. The child has to grow to that stage of evolution where the father is in according to understand the meaning behind it. So, at times, we ourselves are like those little children. We're questioning the actions and justice of God, and sometimes we're quarreling. Murshid himself says, "There is no one who could be accused more often and for so many things as God. The reason is that it is our limited self which judges, though it is quite unable to understand. So another student asked another question. And the question is it not very difficult to avoid judging? For, in order to become just, one has to come to a certain conclusion." And Murshid responds, "Yes, but what man generally does is not only that he judges anyone in the mind, but he's very ready to give that judgment out. He's not patient enough to wait and to analyze the matter and to think more about it. As a rule, a person is not only ready to judge, but also without any restraint on his part, he's ready to express his judgment instantly. He will not think, have I the right to judge that person? Have I risen to that state of evolution? When Jesus Christ himself refused to judge and said, whoever is faultless, it is that person's place to accuse or to punish. It teaches a great lesson. Even in order to learn justice, it is not necessary that we should be ready to judge and instantly express our judgment, our opinion." So with those words, it seems to me as if Hazrat Unai Khan is trying to give us some sort of methodology, some sort of understanding. What is justice? What is judgment? And what is opinion? Again, let us turn to the message for the instructions given. And Murshid says this: all tragedy in life, all misery and inharmony are caused by one thing, and that is the lack of understanding. Lack of understanding comes from lack of penetration. The one who does not see from the point of view from which he ought to see becomes disappointed because he cannot understand. It is not for the outer world to help us to understand life better. It is we ourselves who should help ourselves to understand it better. It's a very interesting idea here, that we are responsible for this understanding. We, in a way, are responsible for our salvation by lifting the veils of the limited self, the selfish self. Would you like to hear that passage again? Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it? All tragedy in life. Think of that. Mercia telling us all tragedy in life, all misery and harmony are caused by one thing, and that is lack of understanding. How profound is that? Lack of understanding comes from lack of penetration. Now he's teaching us something here about meditation, concentration, contemplation. We'll talk more about that. So I begin again. All tragedy of life, all misery and inharmony are caused by one thing, and that is lack of understanding. Lack of understanding comes from lack of penetration. The one who does not see from the point of view from which he ought to see becomes disappointed because he cannot understand. It's not for the outer world to help us understand life better. It is for we ourselves, for we should help ourselves to understand it better. So the key here is, all misery in life comes from lack of understanding. And that lack of understanding comes from lack of penetration. So, again, Murshid is indicating it is we ourselves who are responsible to actually train ourselves. And this is the beauty of the inner school. If we examine our minds and our hearts in all circumstances, patiently, we can begin to determine if we're merely exercising an opinion, passing a judgment about others or even oneself, or truly seeking justice. That is a different matter. But the question now is, how do we do that? Is anyone asking that question? And how do we honestly examine our minds in an effort to understand life better and to seek true justice? And here Mershon gives the answer in the previous quote, through penetration. Now we ask ourselves, how can we develop the art of penetration? Our minds are really so often, at least mine, perhaps not yours, but mine is often very active and sometimes even overactive. It's rarely stilled. This is where our meditation can really help us and serve us. And it's like the sea out there, as sometimes the mind is like the choppy water. We can't get a clear reflection. We don't see so clearly. And we can lose our equilibrium in that choppy water too and fall down. This kind of activity can often lead to a lack of rhythm, which then can lead to a lack of patience. And from that lack of patience, misunderstandings certainly can arise. And this can lead to us feeling isolated, misunderstood, or misunderstanding others. We can feel separated, and we can also feel alienated through our own judgments. So how do we cultivate, again I'm asking, how do we cultivate a way of penetration leading to greater understanding? Two qualities are required to develop penetration. Just two. The first is an open, unhindered heart and mind. One that possesses a kind of childlike curiosity. Be ye as little children. And this can lead to a kind of freedom from the self-imposed restrictions and habitual patterns we often find ourselves in. It's like those lines in the mind that Hazrat Maikon talks about. We have to lift the needle sometimes. The second quality or point is to develop a quality of concentrated effort. Here, effort is an operative word. Concentrated effort is the thing, is the vehicle to help us overcome these habitual patterns. When we see that we are falling in that rut again, we can, with some effort, with our will, in union with the divine will, God willing, we can leap into something more. Concentrated effort helps us to become more open, and in that way, things can become more vivid and fresh. In everything we meet, we can do it anew. Murshid teaches in this regard, when the mind is troubled, it is confused. It cannot reflect anything. It is the stillness of mind that makes one capable of receiving impressions and of reflecting them. In Persian, the mind is called a mirror. Everything in front of the mirror appears in it, but when the object is taken away from the mirror is clear. Nothing remains. It remains in the mirror as long as the mirror is focused on it, and so it is with the mind. The quality in the mind which makes it still at times and active at other times, which makes it reflect what it sees at one time and makes it avoid it at another, so that no outer reflection can touch it. This quality develops by concentration, contemplation, and meditation. The mind is trained by the master trainer by diving deep, by soaring high, by expanding widely, by centralizing the mind on one central idea. And once the mind is mastered, a person becomes a master of life. Would you like to hear that again? Yeah, I think it's very wonderful. When the mind is troubled, it is confused. It cannot reflect anything. It is the stillness of mind which makes one capable of receiving impressions and reflecting them. In Persian, the mind is called mirror. Everything in front of the mirror appears in it, but when the object is taken away, the mirror is clear. It is empty. It does not remain. It remains in the mirror as long as the mirror is focused on it, and so it is with the mind. The quality of mind that makes it still at times and active at other times, which makes it reflect what it sees at one time and makes it avoid every reflection at another, so that no outer reflection can touch it, this quality develops by concentration, contemplation, and meditation. Hazaratanayak Khan further instructs us, then there is a further awakening, which is a continuation of what I have called the awakening of the soul. The sign of it is that the awakened person throws a light, the light of his soul, upon a person and every object, and sees that object, that condition in this light. It is his own soul which becomes a torch in his hand. It is his own light that illuminates his path. It is just like throwing a searchlight upon a dark corner, which one does not see before. And the corners become clear and illuminated. It's like throwing a light upon problems that one did not understand at first. It's like seeing with x-rays persons that were a riddle before. So, if you're willing, I thought we might try a little exercise together and take a little time to experience this beautiful quote here in the form of a meditation. Are you willing to do this? Very good. So please just sit very comfortably in your seat. One should be relaxed and very at home in one's body. And if you feel comfortable, I would invite you to close your eyes and just focus on the breath. And as you do so, perhaps there's something that is in one's heart or one's mind that is a bit of a challenge. And challenges, of course, are opportunities, but often we do not see it as such. So there may be something that we can call forth on which we wish to throw this light of the soul, and by doing so gain greater clarity and insight, and perhaps even find a blessing. So use the breath to go deeper, and just something surely will naturally arise, some challenge, some person that maybe there's a little conflict with that one wishes to resolve, but gaining greater understanding may be very useful. And just continue to breathe and imagine that the door to the chamber of the heart is open and one is throwing all the windows open to the mind. So everything is open and clear, like a clear blue sky. We can use the lines from the precious Sufi prayers by Hazaratanayak Khan as a vicar on the breath, on the swing of the breath, to help move us deeper into this meditation. And I will repeat the instruction, so no need to grasp and remember anything. I will repeat it. As we breathe in, repeat silently inwardly, pour upon us thy love and thy light. And we will continue as we hold the breath, and I again will repeat this for all of us, but we'll hold the breath while we hold the concentration of the phrases, disclose to us thy divine light, that we may know and understand life better. And then when we breathe out, we'll repeat silently, guide us on the path of thine own goodness. breathing in, pour upon us thy love and thy light. Holding, disclose to us thy divine light, that we may know and understand life better and out. Guide us on the path of thine own goodness. And in, pour upon us thy love and thy light. Holding, disclose to us thy divine light, that we may know and understand life better. And breathing out, guide us on the path of thine own goodness. In, pour upon us thy love and thy light. Hold, disclose to us thy divine light, that we may know and understand life better. And out, guide us on the path of thine own goodness. And we'll continue for a few more moments. Repeat the phrases inward and silently. See the light of your own soul shining a light on this situation, or this person, or this circumstance, and bring it into your illuminated awareness. Disclose to us thy divine light, that we may know and understand life better. And in a very open and relaxed way, beyond all judgment, but open to an inner understanding, beyond limitation, we might ask ourselves, what is the great lesson in this situation for me? What is God trying to teach me? What is the blessing that's emerging? See if there's an answer. Were you able to get a glimpse? I hope so. So it's always useful, I think. A very beautiful practice. The significance of the breath can't be overlooked. In Friday's sacred reading, A Universe in Man, Mercia teaches us, the man who knows how to use breath and how to communicate with his soul begins to realize that the universe is within himself. And it is through realizing the universe in himself that man comes to real spirituality. Hazarat Naik Khan also teaches us, The outer life can be illustrated by man's justice, which is covered by his limited experience in life, by his favor and his disfavor, by his preconceived ideas, by the learning he has, which is nothing compared to the knowledge of God. The inner life is something which is within oneself. It has been called a chamber of divine light in one's heart. The door remains closed until an effort is made to open it. Everything becomes spiritual once this door of the chamber of the heart is open. Everything becomes spiritual once this door of the chamber of the heart is open. So if you don't mind, I'd like to give you a little example from my own life regarding judgment and understanding, and how moving from the outer appearances of a situation and attempting to penetrate deeper into the matter, my heart was open to a particular situation where I had a judgment. While living in the Himalayan region of Dharamsala, India, in the mid-1990s, I frequently encountered the bakers in the village. As you may or may not know, the bakers are very curious, and they're very observant. And this allows them to identify anyone new in their surroundings, and, of course, these newcomers for the bakers are the prime clientele. Well, because the newcomers haven't yet become desensitized or hardened by the baker's presence and their unyielding request for money. On the surface, those of us visiting from the West were just objects of the baker's concentration. The bakers artfully observe and position themselves outside restaurants, shops, and temples, and dargahs sometimes. The bakers, they're very sensitive in this way because, of course, any reasonable person, especially if you're in India, you're probably on a spiritual journey and quest. I mean, what reasonable person or sensitive person can refuse the sorrowful face of a bandaged leopard or a rag-tattered mother with a baby at her breast? Especially after one's just filled one's own belly in a restaurant or shopped for finery or gone to a temple to pray, one thinks, I can't pass someone like this. So with much well-developed finesse, the baker's observations and methods, they usually produce pretty good results. Of course, we may have our own judgments about their methods and whether or not, you know, you hear stories, oh, they're really not that destitute and so forth. But here's where the story takes a personal turn, because that isn't the concern here. As the bakers in Dharamsala were observing me, I in turn was observing them. And one day I was walking up the mountain from lower Dharamsala to upper Dharamsala, about a 45-minute hour walk. And I could see the bakers up ahead because, you know, in the mountains, the roads go like this. So I got a glimpse. And there they were. They were all jolly and, you know, they weren't hobbling along at all. They were talking and laughing and, you know, quite animated. And I thought, my goodness, this is a whole different view from what I've seen up in the, you know, in the marketplace. Well, I said to my companions, and Kabri is a witness, she was also there, along with my sister and some Tibetan friends, I said, it's been a good and profitable day for the bakers. Just look at them. Look at how happy they are. So armed with my own observations of the bakers, both while they baked in the streets and now in their sort of natural interactions with each other, I was able to penetrate for just a glimpse and get another view of the bakers. But as the bakers approached, here we go, they started in. You know, hobbling and baking, baby, baby, bakshish, chapati. Some of us know all this. And it was really pitiful. It was like really dramatic change in their behavior. But I wasn't going to be fooled. As they walked closer again, the gestures got more and more dramatic. And you want to know what I did? Yeah, I should tell you. I think it's a very interesting thing. I completely turned the tables. When they got in my close to me, I started doing the same thing. Madam, sir, boopy, boopy, baby, baby, chapati, chapati. And you know what they did? Shall I tell you? Now I've taken you this far, I better, huh? Well, they began to laugh. And they began to laugh. And they began to laugh. And you know what else they did? They went in their pockets and they started to give me rupees. This is extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. But the whole situation completely reversed itself. You know, it was a natural moment, a sincere moment. And at that moment, really, truly, it was something quite remarkable happened because I didn't have a sense of myself or of the mountain or of the sky or of my companions or of the bakers. We were just joined for a moment. There was a union there. It was really very beautiful. And we no longer saw each other as bakers and Western visitors. We were people all sharing in that moment, and we were laughing, and we were smiling, and we were humorously engaged, and we were laughing at ourselves also. It was very remarkable. So by this single act of observance, a little bit of courage to also do this, the doorway was opened. And you know, it connected our lives, and it opened our hearts, and it doesn't end there. We found a way to bridge our understanding to each other as human beings, to share in our humanity. And from that moment until now, still, when I'm there, we call each other brother and sister. We take tea together. We break bread together. My friends that are lepers, they're very badly ravaged by the disease. They've been very kind to teach me about this disease, so I am not afraid of it. They bring their children with them so I can meet the children who are absolutely impeccably well and beautiful. We write each other letters. We have a connection. It's not like we have to make each other separate. I've learned a little bit about the women who are put on the streets. I know sometimes their husbands even have jobs, viable jobs. But if they don't come home with a certain amount of money, they are living with the threat of really severe physical abuse. So again, we've become friends. We share each other's lives. It's opened my awareness to another side of life, different than my own. And it's helped me to, that moment has helped me to see things differently when I encounter things that maybe at once I might judge as grotesque or troublesome. It makes me stop for a moment and question my own judgments and my own reactions. Well, there's another example, a beautiful example, perhaps better than my own. And that example we find in the book Once Upon a Time. In that book, and I've also heard it with my own ears, a beautiful story of Murshid Hidayat. He recalls one day walking through the gate of Fazl Manzil, holding his father's hand. And there in front of the house, and we've seen it in the film, there were workmen. I don't know if they were the same workmen, but we know there are workmen there. And there was a workman, I understand it was pouring rain, and the man was in muddy clothing, and his whole body was in mud. And Murshid Hidayat tells us that his father, Hazrat Naik Khan, walked over to the man, and he took off his hat, and he offered his hand to the workman to shake it. And the man was completely spellbound. By being greeted in such a dignified manner by such a kingly figure. Murshid Hidayat also recalls that as Hazrat and Icon turned to walk a few steps more down the road, there were some of his murids waiting and who had witnessed what had happened. Instead of the murids showing an understanding, a feeling of sympathy towards this beautiful example of kindness and humility, really. But humility is kingliness, yes? They said to Murshid, these students, "But Murshid, you can't do that in the West. Don't you know that you're not supposed to shake the hand of a workman?" To this, Murshid responded, "Are we not all children of one and the same Father? Are we not children of one and the same Father?" This beautiful lesson of Hazrat and Icon hearkens to the teaching for the Sufi who sees in every form the divine form, in every heart the divine shrine, to judge anyone, whatever be his position, his action, his condition, is altogether against his religion. In the bowl of sake we find, the more elevated the soul, the broader the outlook. And last, from the unity of religious ideals we're taught, think of the life of the great master Jesus. One sees that from beginning to end, there was nothing but love and forgiveness. The best expression of love is that love which is expressed in forgiveness. Those people who came to Jesus with their wrongs, errors, imperfections, all was forgiven. For there was always a stream of love which always purified. The lover of good loves every little sign of goodness. He overlooks the faults and fills up the gaps by pouring out love and supplying that which is lacking. This is real nobility of the soul. Religion, prayer, and worship are all intended to ennoble the soul, not to make it narrow, sectarian, or bigoted. One cannot arrive at true nobility of spirit if one is not prepared to forgive the imperfections of human nature. For all men, whether worthy or unworthy, require forgiveness. And only in this way can we rise above the lack of harmony and beauty. May God bless us with hearts full of love and forgiveness. May God grace us with hearts overflowing with such greatness, so much so that the outpouring of love fills all the gaps. and may our outlook become inspired and informed by the message, become broader and broader, and guide us to an elevated consciousness of greater understanding and the sublime reality of God's true justice.